High FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
I'm beyond delighted that my next guest is on the line with me. He is Rudy Rochman. He's a Jewish and Israel rights activist. And Rudy, I don't know if you remember, but you and I spoke probably about 3-4 years ago. It has been quite a while, so it's great to have you back with me here on High FM.
Thank you for having me, and I do remember.
Well, there we go. That's a good start. I also bumped into you in Jaffa by, I don't know, it was 2-3 years ago, but That it was good. It was good to see you live and not just on social media. Well, I wanted to catch up with
Hashem next time in Jerusalem.
Can I say I'd prefer Tel Aviv? I'm allowed to say that. We'll talk about that another day somewhere else.
We'll talk another day.
Really, I was interested in catching up with you because you were on the front lines then of Jewish identity and activism. You were at university campuses. You were involved in Jewish storytelling. You just had a very different, very interesting perspective. For listeners who haven't followed your work, say, in the last year or two, what does the last year or two look like for you? What have you been up to?
For sure. So apart from being a fighter on the front lines in the physical battles of Israel, obviously the past 2 years, we've had several wars starting in October 7th, where I was in Kfar Aza, and in Gaza and Lebanon and Syria. There's also ideological wars that our people are facing in the public spaces and intellectual spaces and the political arena. And so I've been focused a lot there, as I have been for over 10 years now. That could be on college campuses. That could be also in the media, on Fox News, CNN, all the different from the far right to the far left. People are seeming to all agree on one thing, which is the Jews are the problem. Apart from that, my primary focus, I think, when I'm not at war, when I'm not fighting, is finding a way to empower the next generation of Jews, to give us the tools to not just be practicing Judaism, but to put Judaism into practice, to know who we are, to debate, to be able to have the courage to defend ourselves, to know all the counter narratives that exist against us so that when we face it, we can respond, and also bringing the tribes of Israel back home. I've been working on a project for many years now to find these communities that have been disconnected, dispersed from the mainstream Jewish line, primarily in Africa right now, but also in Asia and South America, and to bring them back to the consciousness of our time.
Well, that's a podcast series all on its own, and I look forward to that. But I want to talk more about you, because I do remember very strongly at the time, and this was, as I say, 3-4 years ago, you were advocating a future where Jews and Arabs could live together, sharing this one piece of land. I think you were very open about acknowledging Jewish indigeneity as well as acknowledging Arab indigeneity, which at the time was quite a revolutionary thing to be saying publicly. And I'm just wondering whether after the trauma of October the 7th, there's been any kind of significant shift in your thinking on that particular point.
Sure. So I definitely have never said, nor do I believe, that Arabs are indigenous to Judea. Arabs are indigenous to Arabia. To be indigenous means that you are the original population, that your identity was born and rooted to a specific piece of land, that you've maintained a constant presence, and you are not the post-colonial identity. The Palestinian identity, although a native identity, meaning that it's from specifically this place, it is not an indigenous identity. An indigenous identity is also not an individual's connection, but a collective's connection. And obviously the first indigenous population to this land could only be one, and that's the Jewish people. Now, Palestinians are mostly the descendants of Jews that were forcibly converted to Christianity and Islam, mixed with other Arabs who poured in, who were Arabized with time, mostly converted to Islam. And then this new post-colonial identity was created called Palestinian. That has a connection to this space of land, but it is not an indigenous connection. It is a native connection. So there is no right to declare your self-determination on top of Israel, but there is right for you as an individual to have access to this land. Now, before I talk about how we can have a future plan together, we need to review the options. I mean, the options on the table is either one side is going to kill the other, which I don't see that happening. I don't think all the Jews are going to kill the Palestinians, all the Palestinians are going to kill all the Jews or Israelis. That's not going to happen. So let's put that to the side. The second option is one side is going to kick out the other. And I don't see that happening either. I don't see all the Jews being kicked out or all the Palestinians being kicked out. So now we have two other options. Either we continue to the status quo, or at some point we build something that works for both. And in order to build something that works for both, we have to understand the non-negotiables that exist on both sides. Now, the non-negotiables for the Jewish side is that Israel has to have full political, economic, and military control over this land. Jerusalem is our capital, and Third Temple is built. That's what we've been talking about for thousands of years. Those are the non-negotiables, in my opinion, on the Israeli side, that I'm very open and honest with any Palestinian, any Muslim, any Arab, any person on any other side that I speak to, including Jews. Now, what the non-negotiables are on the Palestinian side, and this is for their narrative, not my narrative, it's right of return and freedom from the river to the sea. And to suggest otherwise than those two is like coming to a Jew and telling them that Jerusalem is not important. Obviously, the Jews are going to say, well, of course, Jerusalem is important. Some of us might like Tel Aviv more, but at the end of the day, for thousands of years, when we've been talking about next year being somewhere or getting married, we've been talking about Jerusalem. And even if an individual might not like traveling to a place so much, it is still central to the collective Jewish history and the collective Jewish future. So how do we create a reality where those two things exist, where we have full economic, political, and military control? Jerusalem is our capital, third temple is built, and they have right of return and freedom from the river to the sea. Now, the Jewish people aren't inherently against the idea of right of return for Palestinians or freedom from the river to the sea. We have a problem with the consequences of what it means today. And the consequences means no longer having a demographic majority, which means no longer a Jewish state,
yeah,
and also importing a lot of people who today, we can even say the majority of them, are very anti-Israel. So how are we going to be able to create that reality by inviting people in who want the destruction of our very civilization? So if we're at A, getting to G takes going to B, C, D, E, F before you get to G. And there's many things that have to happen before getting there. Now, the main two issues that come up with this idea of Palestinian right of return and freedom from the river to the sea is twofold. One is a demographic issue, and the second is a cultural issue. The demographic issue can be resolved by doing what we should do, which is allow the rest of the tribes of Israel to come back. Today's 16 million Jews that we are in the world is the descendants of 2.5 tribes, Judah, Benjamin, and half of Levi. The majority of the tribes of Israel are missing. 9.5 tribes, Issachar, Zvulun, Gad, Asher, Reuven, and I can go on, are missing and need to be brought back. And these communities exist in Africa, in Asia, and South America. And if we did the right thing and allowed our family to have access into our homeland, we would be talking about tens of millions of Israelites returning back to the Jewish people and returning back to the land of Israel. And when that would happen, there would no longer be a demographic threat. Now, there would still be a cultural problem. You still have a large population who rejects your identity, who rejects your ability to have statehood. But that could also change with the conditions. If we look at China and Japan that hated each other for generations, the Vikings and the British, even the Germans that hated the Jews and did the Holocaust and killed 6 million Jews, 10 years later, they were supporting the state of Israel. Why? Because the conditions changed. Now, we need to change the conditions in this land and be like King David. King David was strong physically, relentless against all enemies, but also had extreme compassion against those that weren't. And we're doing neither. We're not strong with our enemies, and we're not compassionate with those who aren't. So first of all, we need to be much stronger with terrorism, completely eradicate Hamas, Hezbollah, Houthis, the Iranian government, completely free the regions of their terror, and not just do things halfway and then get out and then wait for it to be a problem again. Completely eliminate our enemies. But once you do that, what do you do with the population? Well, have compassion for them, invest in education, in infrastructure, in jobs, in roads, in recycling plants. And all of a sudden, if the experience of Palestinians was one that Israel cares and helps them and doesn't allow the only source of information to be Hamas because there is no more Hamas, then all of a sudden, within the course of 10 years, you can shift the culture. And within 10 years, you can get to a place where the culture has shifted, the demographics are no longer a problem, and we can be able to move forward.
Rudy, I'm listening to you. I'm following what you're saying. I'm just thinking on certain levels. I mean, what a messianic vision you have. I mean, these are not achievable steps from here, tomorrow to next year. This is a whole philosophy of an approach to a conflict, which is very different to anything that I've heard before. I'm hearing you talk and I'm hearing you compare what's going on with Israel's enemies in the past to what's going on today. I'm thinking the difference is it's written in a book that they believe in. I mean, how do you supplant a belief that's in a book? I'm just not seeing how this happens. I wish it would. I just don't know how.
A lot of people said this about Zionism too. Like, oh, this is a crazy idea that the Jews should be one day come back to Israel and like that's insane. And yet we did it. We are the people of miracles. But to get miracles, it takes work, and a lot of people put in the work for us to get there. In terms of the book, I'm assuming you're talking about the Quran.
Exactly.
What's very interesting in the Quran is there's two names for the Jewish people. We're either called Yahud or we're called Bani Israel. Now, what's interesting is every single time that we're referred to as Yahud, it's always negative. but it's always negative in response to how we are acting. And the Yahud character in the Quran is always someone that's deceitful, hating on one another, sinat chinam, as we call it in Jewish culture, practicing idolatry, doing all the things that our culture says we shouldn't do. And the reaction of Islam is to reject us and hate us. However, when they're describing us as Bani Israel, the children of Israel, it's always the Jewish people that are united, loving one another, no idolatry, doing exactly what they need to do. And in those moments, we need to be respected, followed, and not even argued with. And so it's almost as if the universe, Hashem, programmed the Muslims to respond to us based on how we act. If we are fighting one another, refusing who we are, assimilating, the reaction is going to be negative. And if we are united with one another and doing exactly what we're going to do, then the reaction is going to be positive. Now, it's very important to also separate what's written in hadiths and what's written in the Quran. It's like someone bringing up a position of a rabbi in the Talmud and saying that's the same thing as the Torah. It's not the same thing. So there's a difference between reviewing something in a hadith, which someone says, I heard Muhammad say this at one point, and so I'm writing this down, versus something that's actually written in the Quran. And in the Quran, it's very clear. When the Jews act like who they need to be, we will respect them. And when the Jews do not, we will reject them.
Once again, I mean, there's a lot to digest here, and I don't think a 10-minute interview does you or the station justice. I think we need an hour's podcast to delve into all these issues in great depth. What kind of reception are you getting to these ideas on, say, American campuses?
It depends who you're speaking to. I mean, I can't just say that the message that I have, every single person, it resonates with them, which is why every time I speak to someone, I try to find out who they are. Are they someone that's right-wing, left-wing? Are they atheist? Are they Muslim? Are they Christian? Are they Jewish? Are they Jews that are against Judaism and against the Jewish people? So you really have to figure out who you're speaking to. But I would say that for the non-Jewish audience, when you are a strong Jew, you're not afraid to say the truth in front of their faces. You're not afraid to call out the lies. And you're not afraid to say the things that some Jews may be uncomfortable with. You know, like talking about the fact that for thousands of years, we've been talking about rebuilding our temple. You know, just as any culture that had the most important place destroyed would want to rebuild it, I'm not afraid to say to them. And actually, when you're not afraid, that's when they respect you. But at the same time, I also humanize the other side. I'm not speaking with hateful rhetoric. I'm not speaking in zero-sum games where we have to destroy it's one or versus the other. And when you do that, they also don't experience you as an enemy. Now, sometimes it takes, you know, maybe 20, 30 minutes to break away the conditioning of anyone that's a Zionist or an IDF soldier must be my enemy. And after hearing a few things that shows them that I'm not their enemy, then they're more open-minded and can continue the conversation. But each conversation is different, but overall, they end positive. And even when they don't end up positive, a lot of times I get messages years later saying, you know, you planted some seeds in me in that conversation. I rejected it at first, but then I started to realize that I don't have to be anti-Israel to be for the Palestinians.
Rudy, we're going to leave it there. I'm out of time. Thank you so very much. It's not going to take 4 years until we speak again. That is for sure a lot sooner than that. Thank you for being with me on Chai.